All right, so Ruth Bat Moshe Viachat, and also, and so my grandmother is Miriam Bat David. We're dedicating our learning today. God, that should be a Aliyah Neshama for their lofty souls. Okay, so we're going to look at this coming Sunday. So we have a week to drink a lot and to eat a lot, and we're going to have starting the 3-week period, which is Shavuot Sabbat Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, and then the back end is Tisha B'Av, right? Okay, so now, historically, what happened was, the Jews come out of Egypt, and 50 days after their exodus, they get to Mount Sinai. They get to Mount Sinai even earlier, but the idea is that from 50 days from there, they get to Har Sinai, to Mount Sinai, and they have the revelation. Moshe goes up. Now, exactly what was given at Har Sinai is, you know, people have this misconception that Moshe came down with the scroll, you know, that we take out of the Ark on Shabbos. That's not what happened. No such thing happened. And he didn't come down right away. So he goes up there, and this whole event, he goes up, he comes down, goes up, goes down. Then there's a very big stress on Hagbalah, which means like creating a set area of where people could go and not go. There's this idea of really kind of the idea of boundaries was really something that was very much accentuated at that time. If you go and you open up and you look at the texts, you see this incredible, a lot of effort and time is spent on this idea of boundaries. Which, if you look further into time, let's say when they open up the Mishkan also, there's this, you know, the idea of demarcation. And we have this today, that when you go up to, if people want to go up to the Temple Mount, where can you go? And just the idea, if we take out the Masechet Kelim, it talks about, you know, different levels of sanctity as you get closer to the Holy of Holies. So when you go to the Kotel, actually, when we're standing there, we're actually at the back of where the Holy of Holies was. And so, and then from there, as it goes further away from there, as you get from the different parts, you get to, and the idea of setting up boundaries, of areas of differentiation. These are all important things in terms of when we try to get to understand Kedusha, sanctity, and how we relate to experiencing a more intense experience of Hashem, that there's this setup of these areas of distinction. And so Moshe goes up there. That's like a parenthetical, but it's an important idea because we talk about it actually equates very much to like how we have relationships, and in terms of the idea of boundaries, it's not like a, you know, like you hear like a modern day psychologist or person talking about these things. This is going back to Mount Sinai. So fine, so Moshe goes up there. And then after that communication of the Ten Commandments and whatever other information, perhaps like more is being given, more or less, you know, whatever that is, but definitely not the five books. That's something that's given and develops over the 40 years of the Jews being in the desert. But we get to, so that event of the revelation, Moshe stays up there. And he's there. What the Jewish people are told is it's going to be a 40-day period. And then at the end of 40 days, Moshe's going to come down with the tablets. The joke that I heard recently, Rabbi Breidowitz said, he goes, you know why a Jewish wedding never starts on time? Because the only time the Jews were actually like careful about time, they messed up royally with this and the golden calf. So after that, no Jewish wedding ever started on time because the precedent, it didn't work out. So put the washers away. We're not going to be exact. Yeah, I think so. I believe so. Yeah. Okay, so the idea was, they were told it's a 40-day, you know, waiting for Moshe. And exactly what went on there. So, and this is, again, we in our state of where we are, we have a hard time necessarily relating, understanding exactly who Moshe was. In the last couple of parashas that we read in the Torah, starting from Miriam's, you know, Lashon Hara, quote unquote, about Moshe, and then continuing on with different challenges to his position, we start to get a sense that Moshe is not your average guy. He's like a different person, meaning that he's able to suspend all his own personal projections, and he's able to experience God in a way that no one in history is ever able to do. So Moshe is completely unique, and his prophecy is unique, and his ability to experience this otherworldliness is unique. So that when he goes up there, it says that he didn't eat for 40 days. We can't even, like, what does that mean? Like, what? He couldn't drink.
You had trouble fasting for 1 day.
Right, right. We're like, what? For how many hours? So, you know, so Moshe, it's important sometimes, and the Rambam, he states, one of the 13 principles of faith is understanding that Moshe's his prophecy is unique, and everything is predicated on the prophetic vision, and his experience or his ability to interface with God in a way that's just otherworldly.
He didn't need food for sustenance.
So it could be like, you know, like we have like the man, right? The man itself also, we can't even relate to it. We, you know, how, what exactly that was, one of the things that's just as a side about the man, it says that they see this thing and they didn't know what to call it. They couldn't necessarily relate to it. And so they said, what is this? It's like man, like as the way of saying, we don't know what this is. And then later on, they give the same name because it's something that you can't really give a name to. So the idea of not naming something is to say that something has, and when you have something that's completely like, or it's not really physical, or it's like literally, you know, barely physical, so you don't name it. Like the idea that we have the name of God. Like if you open up a siddur, yud, and then the hey, and then above and the hey. How do you pronounce it? We don't pronounce it. And as a matter of fact, Jehovah is not the way you pronounce it either. I heard from Rabbi Weider down around the corner, he said that if you look at the vowelization, it changes. Because that's not even how when we say Adonai, that's because it's vowelized, but it's the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey, we pronounce it something different, and it's vowelized based on the vowels that it's given under the yud, the hey, and the vav. Like you can say that same thing, Elohim. You'll see a segel, and it's so that it's you're taking this thing, it's not, you never pronounce it, but you're gonna you'll vowelize it and then use a different, like Elohim or Adonai. Those are like the two that we don't pronounce. Why? Because God is not definable. There's no, you can never, and so therefore we can't give, by giving a name, if we ever really name God, we would actually be trying to, you know, create, right, a definition, which you can't, right? It's beyond definition. So that's
just the name of God. Not like it's a two word.
Like
there's like 20 names.
But the Ein Sof is like the way that, like, you'll see that in the Tanya. The Tanya like uses that, and then you'll see others that will refer to God as the Ein Sof.
Because it means like
it means the endless one. Endless, right? So that's like when you start like going into that, you know, reference.
Right? I heard even when you start calling in God, right away.
Right away. There's a certain, so that's okay. So that's where, when we talk about, like, when the Rambam talks about avodah zarah, about idol worship, about foreign worship, it's when we get into, and that it, so it's, so it says that Abraham went around and his whole. You know, project was that of he wrote like tractates about Avodah Zarah, and that his issue was that he, like, we have the famous story that everybody tells, that when he was a little kid, he was his dad's, you know, he his father sold idols, and so his dad leaves and then comes back and all the idols were destroyed. What happened? He says, well, this one started fighting with that one and they killed each other. His father says, what are you talking about? They're not, they can't do. He says, well, then how can you worship them? You know, it's like, but the idea of like, so we look at that and we say, they must have been so primitive, right? Like, I mean, of course, you know that, you know, it's like, I'm going to worship this bottle of water. It's like, who? So, but the answer is that they clearly were taking and saying there are certain powers in the world and they were giving it to this, you know, this object. And then, because they were trying to, you know, they recognized that the powers that are greater than them, but they, instead of unifying it and saying it's all one, which is what Avram was about, they said, well, break it up into multiple things, and then it takes away the power, right? Or, I mean, but it, or the idea of projection. Like, Avram was looking at this and he was saying, you know, we want to define, you know, what God is. I say that Rav Kook used to say that we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to atheists, because atheism says we don't believe in the God that you've created, right? So we create images of God, and these people come like, I don't believe in that. So, you know, but he's saying, Rav Kook is saying, like, you know, the truth is that there, in a sense, there is a certain element of truth to what they're saying, because we are all like guilty of this. We have like a certain limited aspect of ourselves, and then we project it to, let's say, okay, I want God to be, you know, X, Y, and Z. So we all, this is a struggle that we all have to, you know, we all deal with. So now fast forward, we're going to come back to this. We're here at Moshe at Mount Sinai, and the real, like the major thing that happened here is he comes late. Moshe became this, you know, this important, you know, I don't know how you say this, figure of maybe a little bit of God in a sense. Like, he had certain elements of godliness that, as he, you know, the Jews related to him. And when he's leaving and he's absent, then they need to replace him. And so they come running to Aaron and they say, Moshe's not here. We need to have a replacement, and we need to make a god. And they make the egel, they make the calf. And so on, so they make the calf, and then if you read through the story, usually I do more textual, but I'm like, you know, less text today, okay? So, but the idea of, and you can go through the story, but it's important to see, because the strangest thing that happens in the story is that Moshe's up there, and God says, you know, your people, I like this, like, you mean my people, you know, but it's your child, you know, like, you know what your child did? So, like, the you know, they messed up, right? And so Moshe doesn't break the tablets at that point, right? So what does Moshe do? He starts right away defending the Jewish people, and don't kill them. And he basically, you know, whatever, you know, God wanted to do at that point, Moshe's already averted any of that destruction. But you see that, and then the question is, so if you watch what's going on, so they come to Aaron and they say, we need to do this. And Aaron, you know, there's a whole issue. You know, this last parsha, we see that Aaron dies. So, and the reason that's given as to why he died is because he was part of Moshe hitting the rock when Moshe was supposed to speak to the rock. But the truth is that he didn't do anything. He was just standing there, you know. So part of what they explain is that really he still was being held accountable for making the egel, the calf. That always was going to be there. That always, that issue is always in the background at play when it comes to Aaron. So like, even when Aaron becomes the high priest, and then you're making the temple, the tabernacle, and all these different things, he struggles with this issue. You know, like, who am I to do this? I'm the guy who was involved in making the worst, you know, exhibition of public idol worship in the history of the Jewish people, right? So, but still, at this point, Moshe doesn't break the tablets. You know, God just told him that the Jewish people did this. He doesn't break the tablets at that point. So, yeah.
Just a quick question. Did you say, so 40 days he went, people knew he was going to be up there for 40 days. Mm-hmm. He didn't come down after 40 days.
They counted
wrong. So they counted wrong. Good. So there's a mistake. There's something that went off there, that there was a miscommunication, right? So either they expected him to come back earlier, which he didn't. So something's off there, right? That's what I said. That's
how late after was that.
It's not, yeah. Not a day. Or, yeah, it's, I mean, not even clear. Like, we're talking very small, right? But we were just talking about this last night. I was talking to some friends about this issue. Like, you know, when it talks about Adam and Eve eating in the garden. So it says there, that Adam says to God, it's a very interesting lashon. It says, "Ve'ochel, I will eat again." Meaning, he says he did this. He says, "I'll do it again, and I'll keep on doing." Meaning, like, this is like, in a way, the midrashim say, Adam's line to God is, "This is a setup. This was a setup from the beginning. Like, this was, like, you know, meant to kind of play this way." So kind of like at this stage of the Jewish people's development, the whole Cheder Egel, which is till today, we're supposed to, like, we suffer from it, but that in a weird way, part of like this whole how we developed as a people. It's almost like va'ochel, like I do it again. It would happen again, so to speak, because it was going to happen. If it happened, it's because there's something in our development that, you know, we're going to struggle. Yeah, that required. We're going to have to struggle with this. So the question though is: so God tells Moshe about it, but he doesn't break the tablets. He comes down from the mountain, and then he sees something, and then he breaks the tablets. So he didn't believe God. Like, okay, maybe this is the idea of seeing is believing, maybe that's why. Or is there something else that he saw? So what was added, if you read the text, what was added on when Moshe came down is he saw the Jewish people dancing, and there was a certain levity, but also, like, the way it's described is that they made mechalot, which means that not only did they think that what they did was okay, but they were now, like, encircling it, that they were celebrating it. It's like, it's one thing to, like, you know, say, this is okay, now I'm going to go to the next level, now I'm going to celebrate this, you know, like, not only did I mess up, but now I'm going to, you know, it's like, now I'm going to make special courses in college to study, you know, making an eagle, you know, it's like, I'm going to formalize it.
They should have almost been, all right, we're doing this because Moses didn't come back, they should have almost been warning that.
Correct.
And yeah, they are celebrating.
Right, so that's, so he, when he saw the machalot, it says that that's when he broke the tablets. They said that there are three things that Moshe did on his own without consulting God. And this is one of them, where he broke the tablets. And at the end of the Torah, it says about that basically Moshe's praised for breaking the tablets because he understood that if the tablets would have stayed with, you know, with this type of conduct, it couldn't last. What was lost was, so there are these periods of like, here you have the Jew. So yeah, let's go back to Adam and Eve. So Adam and Eve, they eat from the tree. They're kicked out from the garden, and death comes into the world. We talked. This also came up yesterday that you know, before the sin, Adam and Eve. It says two people went up to the bed, and four people came down. There was no 9 months. There was nothing. It was literally. Like the child was conceived and born, and maybe even came out like mature. How do I know that? Because one of the curses that comes out of is that God says, "Bitzar," you know, that you'll have pain, you'll have to go through this difficulty in giving birth. So it means that there was no pregnancy before the sin, and that after the sin is when pregnancy and the whole 9 month, you know. But that again, you see this idea that there's a change. In terms of development, that this idea of what we are so used to, the fact that we'll have a baby and that the baby, or even the idea of conception and pregnancy and all that, that whole process of development didn't exist prior to the sin. And death also didn't exist. So it says that when the Jews came to Har Sinai and they had this revelation, whatever they experienced, that literally was a reversal of the curse that came from the eating of the tree.
It's so interesting because if you think of the days of creation, right?
Yeah.
All the animals and the bird, right?
Yeah.
So there was no concept.
Like, right. That's. It sounds like the nature of the world was it was we.
I've heard about that.
Right. Totally different.
Yeah.
Like so for us, it's like we're so used to the idea of development, of pregnancies, of things of that, you know, and then the child being born. And then so in the animal world, it's obviously, you know, the timing is different, but it's a whole different, so it comes to Mount Sinai. So like, in order, like the reason I'm going through this is that in order to appreciate sometimes what you look, you know, there was something different before. So it says that when we came to Mount Sinai and the revelation, we literally, the idea of death and all that went away. It is the damage that had been done from, call it the struggle that we have with the snake, the Nachash HaKadmoni, is always there, that initial going back to the original sin, and that it was all rectified when the Torah was given, when the revelation occurred and the Ten Commandments were given over, okay? So that when Moshe comes down, and then you have the Egel, what he sees is, okay, the dancing, they're entrenching, but they're entrenching in egel worship, in idol worship, in this, and there's no, it cannot coexist with the clarity that had occurred at the revelation. And so he has to break the tablets. So that's, that whatever existed in that moment of 40 days of clarity. Now again, you see that it's almost like there's a need. It says that that from that place, the whole need for the oral tradition and the idea of that we have to develop in Torah and work through Torah and develop, it all comes post the breaking of the tablets. And even in a certain sense, when Moshe hits the stone, the rock, in this week's parasha also, again, it's going back to a need to have to like work hard to get to a place of where, if the ultimate would have been, he could have spoken to the rock and the rock would have given the water, that kind of reality. Even Moshe was trying, like that's already, it's a lot of Kabbalistic discussions. So what, why did he hit the rock? God told him. This is Moshe, he listened to everything God said. Like, why would he not speak to the rock? He was told to speak to the rock. So again, there could be that this part of this need for us to get to a place of where we have to work towards and develop towards getting to that next level, or to the, whatever levels of our connection to God, it's going to be a process of effort. And so there's this, like from Adam to the Jews at post Mount Sinai, there's this, you know, you keep on reverting back to this place of where I can't get the handout, so to speak. It's like we call it Nahama de Kisufa, the bread of shame. Like the idea of getting bread or not working for like your bread, of not earning something, right? So like that's what's referenced in Nahama de Kisufa, is bread of shame. This idea that we, you know, somehow like we keep on going to a place where we almost like shoot ourselves in the foot, put ourselves in these places. But what ends up happening is that from that, you have a need for this new, you know, like years of development to get back to where we could have been given right away from the get-go. So here we come, Shavasar B'Tammuz. So the 17th of Tammuz is the day where Moshe broke the tablets. And that this is creation of fragmentation, where things were unified and clear and things of that nature from the day of the revelation. And then that the shattering of the tablets. Here are these tablets that are completely from God, the whole communication from God with clarity, where no one would forget ever. There was no death. Literally, this whole reversal back to pre-sin of Adam and Eve, and now shattering of the tablets. And so it's from there. And then this, you know, it, in terms of like the way it plays out historically, from the 17th of Tammuz, you have these 21, 22 days. It didn't happen right away that Tisha B'Av came, you know, a year, I think it was a year, if 17th of Tammuz, it must have been a year and a half later, a year and a couple months later, that when the spies left, a year later, actually they left at the beginning of Tammuz to go into the land. So it's the beginning of the month of Tammuz. They go in and they're there for 40 days. And they come back at the end of 40 days on the 9th of Av, and they give over their negative report. And the Jewish people start crying. That's Tisha B'Av. So within this period of time of, you know, it's now a year and a month that you have these two tremendous tragedies that then become, like, you know, after that we see that the Mishnah and Tammuz, the Gemara, they list five things that happen on Shavasar B'Tammuz, five things that happen on Tisha B'Av historically. Now we, you know, we sit on the floor and, you know, after, so Shavasar B'Tammuz is going to be on next Sunday, right? Let's just look at this on the calendar. Right?
It would really be next Saturday, but you go
right,
like,
I come, right?
Next Sunday.
And then Tisha B'Av is going to come out on, it's going to be on, where is it? It's going to be on a Thursday.
Wait, yeah. Shavasar B'Tammuz is on the 17th of
no, but no.
July, isn't it?
Sunday.
Wait, what do I have here? I have the wrong month. Yeah, okay, that's where you go.
Sunday. Well, it's
Sunday. Sunday.
So it's actually the 17th of July is the 17th of Tammuz.
Well, here, no. The 17th of Tammuz is actually Sunday.
July. So here we go. So July 17th, and then Tisha B'Av is on the 7th. Thank you. So right, because it has to be right. 3 weeks. So fine. So on August 7th, we it's Tisha B'Av. It starts on after Motzei. It's on Motzei Shabbos. It starts. Wow. And that's always the Suda the Masechta is always interesting when it's on a Shabbos. Yeah. But
the end.
The end of meal.
What day?
It's going to be on this
Saturday night, 3 weeks later on Saturday night.
Yeah, so it starts on
the 7th of August.
The 6th the night, well, and then the 7th. Yeah.
Senior.
I have.
Okay. So right. So it's interesting because from a historical perspective of how. So now, just as a couple of other things that happened on Shavuot Sabbatim was like just to like show like here he had this breaking of the tablets. Another thing that happened on Shavuot Sabbatim is that the Tamid stopped. What's the Tamid? Tamid means always. What is the Tamid? It's referring to the carbon Tamid. So there was a carbon that they brought every day.
Sacrifice
that was brought daily. And you know, like Cal Ripken Jr., right? He had that consecutive. He played like he didn't miss a game for it was like thousands of games. What was it? What was his streak?
I'm not a baseball guy.
Mahavdil, right?
No, it was like 17 years.
Where it's like some crazy thing. He didn't miss it. He did not miss any game. So this is like, so now take that and like multiply it, you know, to the, so that for hundreds of years, they never missed a day. Of bringing that sacrifice. Now, the weird thing is that it makes a reference to the fact that it even started prior to that happened from Har Sinai, that they already were bringing this. Okay, but either way, the Cal Ripken Jr. record, I feel bad saying, but like, you know, but just to give that idea, like amazing consistency, right? That the consistent carbon, and then it was broken on Shavuot Sabbatim also. So you start to see like there's something about like shattering of things that were and that should have been or could have been and that are broken on the 17th of Tammuz. Also, it says that the walls were breached during the Second Temple, Bar Kokhba's revolt. He was a Torah scroll that one of the original Torah scrolls from Moshe was also burned, destroyed. So like an idea of like having a consistency or something that's reaching back and connected to. There's a stoppage of on Shavuot Sabbatim. Things are broken. Things fall apart. Now, it's very, you know, in terms of like when Jews are where they're supposed to be. So the Maral in Netzach Yisrael, he says that there's certain things that God. Maral lived in the 1500s. He was like if you read the Sfarim, he'll constantly quote Maral.
I've heard. Yes.
Yeah. So the Sfarim lived in the 1800s. Yeah, the Maral lived in the 1500s. He was a precursor to Hasidic thought. Like they, a lot of the Hasidic grand rabbis will revert back to him. So the Maral says that God created the world in a way that nations would actually have their place. Like, you know, this nation belongs in this part of the world, and this one in that part, and that this, each place, each group has a natural place that they should be. And that also, by nature, things should be unified, that there should be a unification, that things should be together, not separated. He calls it pizor. Like, it shouldn't be, like, scattered. And then, also, each group should really have its own autonomy. That a person should not have, you know, there shouldn't be this idea of one group being subjugated under the rule of another group. Everybody should have autonomy. Those are the three things that he explains are natural phenomena, that God created a world where that you'll have groups connected, not spread out. Like it's not normal for a group to be like spread out all over the world. That's just not the way it should be. Like, things should be totally connected and in one place. They should have their place. They have a natural place that they belong, that this is where they should reside, and also autonomy. And so he said it's not natural for the Jews. Here he is living in 1500s in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and he's saying that Jewish people, they belong in the land of Israel. We shouldn't be scattered, and we should have our own, we should be autonomous. And so, but what's interesting, like he just says it very clearly, like the Jews, our natural place is to be in the land of Israel and not to be scattered. And so like the idea of like you're seeing now, like slowly happening, you go and like Jews from every part of the, like the Pizor is starting to go away. into the place of Israel and to have this, you know, we're still working on the autonomy thing. I think we're still trying to figure out how to work with that, right? So that's why you have like election after election, because we're still, but you see that what he's describing. So like in the Shavasar Batama's idea, when Moshe broke those luchos and created fragmentation, so the fragmentation is in thought, it's in ideas and how we work on how we deal with things. But the idea also, you see that there, that part of like being, it's really like the opening to like being in exile, to being in a state of exile. And so that idea of fragmentation, of the fragmentation of the tablets, right, of that, you know, in a way, like the Jewish people, the fact that literally you can go anywhere in the world and there's Jews, like, you know, we were literally mefuzar, like completely spread out, that eventually that scattering will in a way, slowly but surely, in the kibbutz galiyot, like the ingathering, you see that the natural state of the Jewish people is to be together. In a way, like you see that in the way we, our communities are set up, that we end up, you know, kind of always like settling and being, you know, around, clustered in areas together, because in a natural way, like one of the things that, in reading the Maral, in terms of like what things should be natural, one thing that's coming out is that Judaism is not just a religion; we're a nation, right? So that we have a national identity as well, and so that idea comes through in the morals, you know. So it's like in contrast that some, I think, streams of Judaism will look at Judaism and say, "No, this is just a religion." So Reform Judaism, that was kind of what they were when it's, you know, in Germany, and they started. You know, in Europe, the whole, you know, reform movement was actually stripping out Jerusalem, having the land of Israel as being a place that we, you know, that's our goal to get to. That was actually very much, you know, taken out, like the idea of temple. Like, you don't need to be anywhere. You don't need to have a temple in Jerusalem. You can have a temple around the corner here in Teaneck, New Jersey, which you have a temple, right? So, like, the idea of temple, like, that all was stripping out the idea of the nation of Israel. And so, yeah.
Is it a similar theme where it continues on to the bubble and everybody's now separated and that fragmentation we're talking about just...
Yeah, so when we went into exile, that was, you see that there's fragmentation. Like, exile is defined by not being in the land of Israel, not having autonomy, and being completely spread out, right? And even within that, you still saw that there was still that like ability or the desire to want to be, you know, community and to be, you know, together, so to speak, against the Pizar. So like we see
coming back,
what
communication from different languages, different people, different places. We're sort of communicating these days more on a.
Yeah, you're right. So you see that, right? No, so that's actually what you're referencing also, by the way, is the idea that there, you know, now you're going back to a different thing, which is where you had a point in time, and the Torah describes it, of where the Tower of Babel, right? That whole story that, you know, again, God saw that, you know, the unification of humanity created certain issues where they wanted to, like, basically go anti-God. Right, we're going to go and rebel against God. We're going to build a tower that's going to go up to God, and we're going to fight him up there, you know. But that, so in the end of days, there's going to be a reversal of where instead of taking that unification of nations and going anti-God, it will be the opposite. It will be, you know, recognition of God and things of that nature. You know, be like that kind of thing. So just in a practical sense, like, you know, like. Putting practical, so when it comes to the 17th of Tammuz and to Tisha B'Av, these are fast days. So the ultimate goal of a fast day is to basically be a day of doing repentance. It's supposed to be a day of reflection. And so when it comes to Shavasar V'Tammuz, it's a shorter fast compared to Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is really Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur are 25-hour fasts. Right, those are, and not only does it mean not eating and drinking, but there's also additional stuff. There's no person supposed to not have any sexual relations. You're not supposed to wear, you know, leather shoes, And, you know, so you're not allowed to, you know, Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, like putting like oils and, you know, different like washing. And that's all stuff that it's a lot of different things. Whereas Shavasa with Thomas,
same rules, Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av.
Yes, yeah, they are. Even though they're coming from different places, right? Okay. But it ends up net, it plays out the same, okay. Right? But the difference between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur is a happy day. It's not a sad day. It's the happiest day of the year. It's one of the happiest days. Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur are the two happiest days of Jewish calendar. So you have a fast day on Yom Kippur, which is supposed to be joyous. Tisha B'Av is sad. It's a day of mourning. It's really what you're doing is, and really also, but when we get to the seventh, now, say it like this, from the 17th of Tammuz to Tisha B'Av, it's a period of mourning. Now, it's, to take from the Rav Soloveitchik, like, looked at and said, there's nothing in Judaism or halacha that we kind of like make up stuff and not use a model that's prior to it. So like we're going to use a model that's prior to it. He says basically when it comes to Avelut, it's a mourning, we have the dead body in front of us, that's Aninut. Then you have the burial, and from the burial you have this Shiva, right? And then you have the 30 days, right? So from the burial, you have from the burial day, 30 days. And then you have, for a parent, you have 12, right? 12 months. But here what we're doing is we're going to do Aninut is Tisha B'Av. Meis Mutal B'Lefanecha, the idea that the dead body is in front of you is the most intense mourning, that's Tisha B'Av. The Shavuah Shechalbo is the Shiva. And the 7th, the 21, the 3 weeks is the 30 days. Like that's, so like, for, yeah, it's, but it's reversed, right, exactly. So, but you say, so saying like the model is now what I always tell Lana, like when she asks me, like, they have different, you know, what are the laws of the 3 weeks? Like, you can't get haircuts, you can't, some people don't shave, you shouldn't, you know, there's certain things can you go buy new things? Can you not buy new things? So, in terms of like the when you look at the Gemara formulates it as Tisha B'Av. Shavuah Shechalbo, which means that the week, let's say Tisha B'Av is this, there is no Shavuah Shechalbo this year, because a Shavuah starts, a week starts on a Sunday, right? So this is going to come out it comes out on Sunday. So like by the Sephardim who believe that like the way with the end of Paschening is everything is all the intensity is only on the week of Tisha B'Av. We end up starting from the beginning of the month of Av. Right, so we start, we call it the 9 days. So the 9 days have very, you know, that's where, you know, like strict, much stricter rules. Like, let's say also we'll refrain from drinking wine except on Shabbos and eating meat on the from the beginning of Av till Tisha B'Av. Whereas by the Sephardim, they only do it from the week of when Tisha B'Av is. So if like Tisha B'Av was on a Wednesday, so from Sunday to Wednesday would be their, you know, limitation. So here they're like, the wine meat thing is not going to apply this year to them. Okay?
When it's Shabbos, does it go the week before? Because it's...
There's no Shavuah Shechalbo. I believe there's no Shavuah Shechalbo. I'm telling you.
A week between Saturday and Sunday.
I always hear like the joke.
That's why
Jacob's
not here today.
By Sephardim, like the joke is you can have rice. You can have rice on Pesach, but you have to wake up for a full month. You have to get up early to do slichos. So that's like, you know, which would be the trade-off. But here, the Shavuah Shechalbo thing is also another. But either way, so now, but in the Ashkenazic tradition, though, is the Ramah adds and says that we start from Shavuot B'Tammuz, that from the 17th of Tammuz, we start putting, you know, certain limitations in. Also, like, they get married during this period of time. So, but the haircut thing and the shaving thing is also from the 17th of Tammuz. We start putting that, you know, those the shloshim, like the way the Rav Soloveitchik, when he basically has a very important principle that whenever you see any type of newer, these are like talking about thousands of years that they already are doing this, but there's any type of newer institution, it's always being modeled off an existing, you know, set of principles. And so that's what we have here, this idea of shloshim to the shiva, to the anina, like this idea of we're going into more and more intense type of mourning. But to take the real, like the most, I think the most important thing is to realize that when you come to these days of the 17th of Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, so Tisha B'Av is like straight out, we're really like mourning the loss of the temple, probably also we tie in the Holocaust and things of that nature. It's like the day of, like, we pile it on. All the bad things ever happened in history of the Jewish people, we're mourning that day. But part of what we're doing on the Shavuos Ratamas and Tisha B'Av and any of the fast days is always to be a time of retrospection and tshuva, and to say, like, are we, how can we, you know, if we keep on going back the same, we always seem to be messing up on these things. So, like, Shavuos Ratamas is a time we should be looking at how we relate to Avodah Zarah. And Avodah Zarah means projection. You know, like, how we would perceive God, like, working on, like, how, you know, can we improve on, you know, getting a truer, more, you know, understanding of what of God and you know, think anti-Avodah Zarah, okay? And then when it comes to Shavuos, to Tisha B'Av, the idea of all of the history of Jewish tragedy, but, you know, in terms of our relationship to the land of Israel and to the temple and things of that nature, that should be tied in. So that it's again, it's a time of reflection and retrospection. To be and the idea that it's not, God doesn't want us to suffer, but rather the idea of punishment is to try to make a, what we call tikkun, is to try to make a correction and to make things better. And so when we come back to these things, it's like the fact that we keep on coming back to this, these horrible days is supposed to be like, okay, now what? But let's try to figure out how we can make improvements. And it could also be like when we look at Tisha B'Av, that's just like fast forwarding to that. But if things were, if the breakdown was how we were interfacing with each other, then that's another area where we have to look at and say, how do we improve? Like one of the things that Tisha B'Av is about is Lashon Hara, right? Lashon Hara about the land of Israel, about negative speech about others. And so, you know, that breakdown, so now we need to like say, okay, enough with this. Like we need to figure out how can we, in a real way, make change. And so when we come to these times of year, like it's an opportunity. It's not just about, oh, it's like you have this thing about, like you joke about Tachanun, right? So like no one wants to say Tachanun. Why doesn't anybody want to say Tachanun? Because Tachanun really actually, it's the prayer right after Shemoneh Esrei where we go down and we put, we're really talking about, that's death. That's actually like us coming into, like we're recognizing death. So no one wants to say Tachanun if it's about dying, about or referencing death. So who wants to, you know, deal with that? So that's why we have this, like, natural thing of not wanting to... That's why, like, people are the happiest thing. You know, when Jerry Friedman comes in and he's doing a bris, there's no tachanun. We, like, to make a party. It's, like, the happiest... Because we don't have to deal with death that day, you know? So we don't even realize that it is that, but that's what's going on. So here, with these days, with Tisha B'Av and with Shavuos Ratamas, it's like, who wants to deal with it? It's like, oh, it's, like, so, like, A-list, you know? But I think the idea is that we should take this and take pause and to say, okay, this is an opportunity. What went wrong? Here's Shavuos Ratamas. This is what went wrong. Tisha B'Av. And start saying, okay, we can actually do things that can make correction. And if we even on our own personal level make that positive change, that somehow that will reverberate. It's like
chance to reset.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really, I think that's the goal of the day.
Mm-hmm. Rav Kook talks about changing from baseless hatred.
Right. So that's to right. So, but to me, yeah. So that's who's saying that there's an obligation. We all have an obligation to not just believe in God, but to believe in ourselves. I think that was Rav Tzadok. I think might say the same way that we have an obligation to really believe that we're capable. Like it's really have to. Yeah.
I heard you have to liracha kamocha. It's almost like reversed, meaning. How can we really love other people as much as we love ourselves? Or how can we love ourselves as much as we love other people?
Or I used to say,
we have to love ourselves before we can love others.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
Like, what is that?
Right. No, but that's. But yeah. So that, then, what's interesting is Hillel's answer was, "Don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to yourself." He flips it around. What you don't want done to you, don't do to others. That's how he learned in the negative, as opposed to saying the more positive, like love someone else like you would love yourself. Right. Yeah. He said it in more of the, it's interesting how he...
don't do to others
what you wouldn't want done to yourself. Yeah.
Oh.
Should I turn it off?
No.
Okay.
I have a question related to, you talked about how Yom Kippur being the most joyous day of the year, Tisha B'Av being the saddest day of the year, yet it's the same fast. So I know that on Yom Kippur, I believe, on Yom Kippur, when you're fasting, it's to bring you closer to Hashem, get clear of everything, allow you to connect, hence Why it's the greatest day of the year? It's when you're closest to Hashem. Mm-hmm. So on Tisha B'Av, when you're fasting, is it the same purpose to get closer to Hashem to be able to repent, or is it more? I mean, I just want to.
It has no, but it has that. An, but it has an element of loss. Like you're mourning. There's no question that there's a mourning. What's amazing is that not 6 days later is Tu B'Av, the happiest day. So you can pivot, but Tisha B'Av is more.
The focus of so?
I would say like this, because you've gone through it, right? So you go through mourning. It's like there's a sense of loss mm-hmm. that you just have to like work through, mm-hmm. right? That's Tisha B'Av. Okay. So we're really it's there. We you know yeah we're in that process of experiencing and feeling that loss. I guess from there it says anybody that mourns on Tisha B'Av will be able to celebrate the rebuilding of the temple. Like you have to like feel that loss to understand like the sense and be able to appreciate what we're going
to
get.
Experience the highs and experience the lows.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, yeah.
I was going to ask about. Your reference to Ashkenaz and
Sephardi, right?
Right? So there's no right or wrong. It's just if you are that
correct. Type,
then you follow a certain way.
Correct.
Depends who you talk to.
But it's interesting is that the experience work. The experience of like for example like the Sephardic experience is different than the Eastern European experience. Like I get, like the you always said, like put that into practical terms, okay? So a Kohen gets up. A Kohen gets up and duchens, okay? In America or outside of Israel, only the Sephardim do it every day. Ashkenaz only do it during holidays, right? Why? And so the answer is because the Sephardim are happy all the time. It actually comes down to joy. So if you're in a state of joy, you can duchen. All the time. Ashkenaz, it only was on the holidays, and so, but when you go to the land of Israel, then it changes, everybody's in that state. Now, again, it's just that, so it sounds kind of funny, but there's a lot of truth to that, you know, in a weird way that there, that of how it plays. So, the experience of how the Sephardim over history had a different, you know, they experienced and had less oppression in the Arab in the Muslim countries until it was only a recent phenomenon that they were kicked out and this and that. Till that time, they had a much different. They were treated better. It was just a different experience. And so you see it today in Israel. You get there and there's the Sephardim. You go into certain. It's just that there's a certain joy that's maybe we as Ashkenazim have to learn from. But whatever it is.